Welcome to the Africa Tech Summit podcast, sharing insights from across the African tech scene. Today's episode is kindly supported by Raynest and was recorded live at Africa Tech Summit London. Stay tuned for great insights and a discount code to join us at Africa Tech Summit Nairobi, powered by Raynest.
Thank you so much for joining me this afternoon, and it's really good to have this. This is a very big panel, so I have to find a way to make sure we all get a conversation to go on. So the first thing I really want every one of us to talk about is funding. Right now, it's not the best market for fundraising. And also, just last year alone, compared to 2022, over 30%, we experienced over 30% decline in actually fundraising and the market. So when do you think this will end? Do you think there's a very big light at the end of this tunnel? Or do you think this will go on for a while? And I would love everyone to just do a quick 30-second of introduction.
Hi, everyone. I'm Lauren Field. I work for IFC. I lead a global program called Startup Catalyst, which invests in incubators, accelerators, and seed funds in nascent venture capital ecosystems globally, which means we focus heavily on Africa, where many of these markets are located, and about two-thirds of our capital is based there. We've been operating this program since 2016. We've invested in about 22 of these funds globally, and we keep going. So to your question, great way to make yourself look like an idiot is to predict the future. with that caveat, I will go ahead. I think it's probable that we've hit the bottom. This is linked, of course, to global conditions, geopolitics, interest rates, etc. But I think that within the African context, putting those things aside, I don't think you're going to see that 2024 numbers are going to be a continuous decline versus 2023 numbers. So there should be some bottoming out and then some recovery. It's the mechanics of the way that cycles work. I think FX, particularly in Egypt and Nigeria, is a big part of that, which obviously, particularly when you have international investors looking at dollar-denominated returns, this hurts and it makes it hard to continue allocating capital. So with that caveat that FX is really difficult to predict, I think that the market is moving towards a natural bottom. I think that valuations have come down. I think that capital efficiency has improved. And we should see that 2024 figures look better.
Right, thank you so much. We'll talk more on the valuation later. Please. What's your take on that?
Let me start with the introduction.
So
I'm Franny. I am the Director of Corporate Development at Onafrique. We are the leading payment network in Africa. We believe that making a phone call should be as easy as making a payment. We're currently operating in about 40 countries on the continent, and my role is to oversee all of our M&A work as well as all of our fundraising. On sort of the fundraising environment in general,
the dry bar.
I like to think that we've sort of reached a rationalization of the funding environment. So if you look where we were, 2021, 2022, you saw this huge level of exuberance. 2023, you saw a normalization. And I agree with you completely that I think, there's a lot of optimism for the future. You look at the funds that have closed on capital. I think it was $3 billion was raised exclusively for Africa last year. We're going to continue to see money deployed in great companies. I do think one thing that has fundamentally changed, and probably for the better, are due diligence processes. So I think that money will be out there, but I think getting that money is going to require a lot more work on behalf of the companies.
I know, we're talking about fundraising, and the decline. You guys raised $100 million this year. I don't think that's what you can relate with at the moment. But from your own side, the 30-second introduction, and what's it like? And what are we seeing?
So hi, everybody. I'm Ting Ting, Chief Capital Strategy and Impact Officer at Move. We're an African-born global mobility fintech. We provide revenue-based financing, vehicle financing for ride-hailing drivers across 10 markets on three continents. And we operate in three African continents today, serving over 12,000 customers. In terms of the funding environment, I think just a couple of data points to kind of provide the context for the 30% drop in Africa, right? So if you look at European VC funding over the same time period, that dropped by 39%. If you look at the US VC funding, again, same time period, about 30-35%. So I think it was the pullback in terms of African-focused investment was actually, if anything, a bit more muted than the other larger regions where you see the bulk of the VC funding. I think for us, when we look at where we were raising early stage funding in 2021 and 2022, and where we are now raising growth funding 2023, 24, and beyond, as Frenny mentioned, there is definitely a much higher bar for higher quality companies. But at the same time, if you look, you know, at VCs and growth equity funds, they've been under pressure to deploy because everybody's been sitting on their hands because of the last 12 months of volatility and macro shock. So there is pressure now for the GPs, the funds, to actually start putting capital to work. In addition to that, I think, you know, we've had, whether it's through various forms of exits, maybe less so in Africa, but in other markets, liquidity is starting to go back, you know, again, because of investor pressure to show DPI, you know, companies merging, selling to strategic buyers to start creating realization so that the capital can flow back to the LPs, the VCs, and then the LPs to then reallocate. So I think in the next 12 to 18 months, I'm not sure if we're at the bottom yet. So, you know, maybe certain sectors will continue to see a bit more of a funding challenge, but I do think that that capital flows will start to reopen for all stages.
Thanks for this spirit.
David. Hi, everyone. My name is Victor, and I'm the CEO and co-founder of Raynest. And what we do at Raynest, we help freelancers and businesses in Africa to manage their global receivables seamlessly by giving them ability to set up US bank accounts in their name, UK bank accounts, so that they can receive and get paid faster and then lesser transaction fee. So when we look at last year, 2023, there was a global reset in startup fundraising scene globally. Like she mentioned, US as well, there was like 30% drop in fundraising despite the excitement about AI. And this is a market where we have a lot of big funds, where there is a stability when it comes to the regulatory. So a drop of 36% in Africa fundraising is just a reflection of the global trend. But as fundraising starts to pick up globally, I expect more fundraising in Africa to happen, especially for early stage startup, pre-seed and seed. For later stage, few startups will still be able to raise, but there will be needs for them to show impressive growth, maybe path to profitability if they are not profitable. There may also be a way, maybe startup earning in foreign currency. We know the issue when it comes to FX. If all your revenue is in local currency, converting to foreign currency is a major challenge. However, the excitement about investment in African startup has gone down compared to like 2 to 3 years ago, where everybody wants to invest in Africa. So there is need for some changes to happen in African startup ecosystem. Hopefully, maybe one or two exits, either through acquisition or IPO, can bring about this positive excitement for foreign investors to want to invest in Africa. Probably it's time we also try to start telling some positive story about African startups, African ecosystem as well. That will send positive signal. When we look at major markets in Africa, Nigeria, Kenya, and Egypt, there has been some form of regulatory instability. These are also preventing foreign investors from putting money. So stability from the regulatory perspective as well will be helpful in getting more funds down to African startups.
Afternoon, everyone. I'm Nina Triantis. I run Standard Bank's global telecoms, media, and technology sector team. Standard Bank is Africa's largest financial institution. And in these sectors, we help companies across many verticals, financing, capital raise advisory, capital markets for the larger companies that are able to list on exchanges, and also transactional and global markets effects. So my co-panelists have covered quite a lot of the question that you've raised, Adewale, but perhaps a few more thematics, if you will. So whilst we've seen a decline in funding, and I think somebody on the previous panel or one of the previous panels said this, it has been also a good development because you know, the markets were quite frothy. There was a lot of funding going into just top-line growth without a lot of focus on unit economics and profitability, etc. But having said all that, there's still capital available for the right companies. While some global VCs, certain nationalities in particular, are no longer investing as much in Africa, we are seeing other investors. We're also seeing a lot more money going into thematics. So MOVE, of course, is a good example. So you've got strategics coming into the different verticals. It's not all about fintech. So, you know, of course, Uber into MOVE, Sony Innovation into Carry First. And of course, I think we're going to continue to see the thematic investing. We're even starting to see that through LP investments into GPs, where certain verticals, global companies are really looking to promote certain verticals. The other thing that we've seen is an increase in debt funding. So of course, and I know this is one of your questions, so I'm not going to talk about it now. But of course, DFIs have always been quite big in funding, both as LPs, but also in debt funding. But also commercial banks, you have quite a lot of specialist boutiques, impact lenders, etc. And so quite a lot more of the funding has come from debt finance versus equity finance. I mean, we are also looking at other structures. We're about to complete a securitization transaction, first of its kind, in an African country outside of South Africa. So I think there are quite a lot of positives to the story, and like I said, there are more investors, some of your traditional private equity in Africa also setting up specialist funds, or more of them setting up specialist funds to invest into tech in Africa.
And while we're still on the funding environment and conversation, I know IFC, you guys have been busy. Almost all the rounds are closed from the funds. You have one or two things to do with them. What is the role of DFIs in actually funding startup on the continent, especially in this environment?
I'll talk about the environment, and then I'll go a little bit more granular on the forms of funding that we provide. So obviously the role of DFIs is to be a counter-cyclical investor. So I think that in the current environment, it's particularly important that we continue to deploy rationally but consistently, so that when other investors have fled the market, we are still there. And by the way, this is when we make strong returns. Counter-cyclical investing does pay off. So coincidentally, as well as being an important part of our role, our track record clearly shows that this is the smartest time to invest. So I think clearly this is a type of moment when DFIs become important. I think DFIs have always been a critical part of the ecosystem in Africa. I really hope to see that reduce over time. I think that we have a role to play, but the sign of the maturing of the market will be when DFIs are less critical to round closing and to funds closing. Just to go briefly a little bit more granular, of course, DFIs invest in individual companies, typically Series A, Series B onwards. We invest in seed funds and we invest in later stage VC funds. Although we're fairly active in the individual company investments, there are so many startups and we only invest in the tiniest fraction of them. Where I see us really moving the market as a whole is the role that we play as catalytic investors in funds that then crowd in significantly more equity from other LPs. And then particularly in the early stage funds, which I'm a little biased towards because that's where I invest. So we put $5 million in a fund. If the fund raises $50 million, that's another $45 million in. If they then invest $100,000 in a startup and are able to crowd in another $400,000 from elsewhere, the multiplier is really quite large. So I think that's the role of DFIs. We shouldn't be providing all of the capital, but we should be providing the catalytic capital that crowds in others, and we should be consistent in our deployment, even when other investors are not.
And Franny, while IFC is preparing their check, and every other people left the market, so we're in a tough market like this, and you guys operate in like 40 countries. How do you think founders need to stay in the market? We've seen a lot of startups actually shutting down. There was one that raised a lot of money that recently shut down in Africa. So how do you think startups should manage to be alive before the check is written?
Well, the most important thing is to stay alive. Whenever Dare, our CEO, speaks at forums like this or meets with other entrepreneurs, the first thing he says is just don't die. But to do that, you know, there are so many things that matter. I think to speak to one of them, given the theme of this panel, the alignment you have with investors has to be crystal clear from day one on the soft stuff and the hard stuff. I think the soft stuff in terms of the vision you're tracking towards and their ability to support you along that journey. is crucial. And then on the hard stuff, you know, what you're tracking towards at your pre-seed and seed stage is very different than what you're tracking towards at your A, B, and C. And making sure that you're crystal clear on what those things are and that you're able to walk that journey together is so important.
Okay. Why people are staying alive and move when to raise $100 million, which is good, but as a chief capital officer, how do you think a startup raised in this environment? I mean, $100 million is a lot of money, and you guys put in some very big guns like Uber and some of these other people. How do you raise those strategic money at this crucial time?
In all honesty, it was a lot of hard work. The headlines might be, you know, what they are, but there's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, and lots of long nights, sleepless nights that go into it. I think for us, the way that our business model, I mean, we'll sound smarter in hindsight, but the way that our business model is set up, we are B2B2C. So our business success is predicated on ensuring that we are not only serving our customers at the point of need, but we're also enabling our mobility marketplace partners, the Ubers, the Grabs, the Bolts of the world, to solve and drive revenue on their side. I think having built that muscle and built that flywheel effect over time and being able to prove to our strategic partners why we're important and how we can continue to help them scale was one of the kind of critical factors to unlock the strategic capital in our Series B. But then more broadly, how we think about capital raising is, if we have an endpoint in mind in terms of the size of business, the type of business that we want to build, at every stage it's been what type of investor can help us with the next stage, right? So at Series A, we were very clear that as an African-only business, we wanted to have diversity in our cap table. So we wanted a US VC and a European VC because we always knew that we would, from Africa, you know, go global. That's how we constructed our cap table at Series A. Then Series A2 was, okay, so now that we've gone global, where can we go for the more strategic, longer term, patient capital, because VC can be quite cyclical, as we've all seen, where if the tide goes out, we still have investors that have the depth of their balance sheet to support us. So at every stage, it's been working backwards. This is where we want to go the next 12, 24 months. What type of capital do we need that can be helpful to get us there? And then, you know, the process is really about building relationships way before you start knocking on their door for money, and then consistently ensuring that you're delivering against what you say you deliver.
I know your role as a chief capital strategy officer. You really work with the founders during this process as well. What is it like managing emotions on both sides at this period? Because as a founder, I know this journey, it's fundraising period is crazy.
Yeah.
And so what is it like from, I mean, stepping aside and also working with the stakeholders within that period?
I don't think I've ever been asked that question before. I know many of you are probably friends with Lottie and Jide in the room. I mean, I met them, I don't know how many of you know this, but I met Lottie, one of the two co-founders of Move, randomly during COVID because I wanted to go into tech in a role with impact and I wanted to work in emerging markets. So I was driven to join Move from a mission perspective. And at that time, I knew nothing about Africa, had only stepped foot in Cape Town once before. And I also joined very early on. So I joined maybe 6 months after the company initially launched in Lagos. And so I think the values and mission alignment from where I stand and Lottie and Jide, and the fact that I was quite early enabled me to build that kind of relationship from day one where every time we go fundraising, we're in a war room. You know, you're doing this, I'm doing that, and we're all rolling up our sleeves. I think as the business has grown up and we've evolved and we've, you know, hired better, smarter people around the room, we now recognize where our strengths and weaknesses lie. And that's actually been a really beautiful self-discovery process. It's like, you know, I have my strengths and I have areas of interest for my growth, and likewise for Lottie and Jide. And so we're now starting to take on different types of roles within the business for the benefit of the business. But yeah, I mean, I think Elizabeth was talking about, you know, founders having mind space, right, for mindfulness and kind of managing themselves. I think each of us also have our own rituals to do that as well. Mm-hmm. So that helps to keep us sane. And friends.
So. All right, David, I don't know why I kept calling you David. Victor. So I have a friend that his name is David Alade. So whenever I think of it, so Victor, When fundraising and doing all these activities, let's assume these are your investors and your employees. Yeah. What would you like to tell them? You understand, during this period, I mean, they are not the ones, but I mean, they might be. What would you like to tell them from your own seat as a founder?
Yeah, I think our first is for us, we like clarity, even for the employees, like for them to know what's going on with the company. You can see the company data, the company metrics, and then we let our employee understand why we are doing this. And then if we can hit this target, this is what we can get. This is the impact on the company. This is the impact on you as the employee as well. And I think for us as well, as we've been lucky with the set of investors we have, almost all our investors are more of like friends. So there is a form of openness in what's our current situation, where are we having lapses. So with that, it's easier for us to communicate with current investors on our current state and then plan for fundraising. And then thinking about new fundraising, maintaining relationship. I have couples of investors that I spoke to when I was raising pre-seed that they didn't invest, but they ended up investing in the seed. So what I do is maintain the relationship, keep them updated on a quarterly basis. The feedback during the first communications, whenever I'm communicating with them, kind of show the changes we've made since then. I think that kind of make them to have interest in investing in the company. That's one of the strategy we've been using. And then try to go out to raise early before there is need for funds. We've raised like two rounds and it was just like, we're not in need of funds, but we know in the next 1 or 2 years, we might need to like fundraise. So that gives us leverages to be able to be picky when it comes to investors, because we're not eager to raise at that particular time.
So Nina, right now, we're still having conversation on fundraising in the market right now. And it looks like corporate organization like you and your name, I'm trying not to murder it again, Loria.
You're not overcomplicated.
Just forgive me.
I told you it doesn't matter.
I know, okay. So, it looks like the checks on the market are coming from corporate organization like you, Standard Bank and others. So right now, how do you work in M&A and some of these things? How do banks really work with startup at this moment? How do you support startup at this moment in the market?
We work with them in different ways. I would say that for a bank like Standard Bank, typically we wouldn't work with very early stage companies. You know, companies would have to be at a slightly more mature stage of development for us to work with them. But on the funding side, we now are focusing more and more on local currency funding. I think one of the issues that a lot of fintechs and other techs have experienced have resulted as a result of the mismatch between, you know, the revenues and the, you know, and the cost base, etc. So we are trying to do that as much as possible. Different type of funding structures for different companies. We are supporting remittance companies with settlement lines so they can grow faster. We provide float finance. There have been companies, frankly, that are, you know, quite profitable, and we've even done dividend recaps so that investors can take some money back and potentially, you know, pre-IPO financing, you know, down the line. We've even done some local currency debt funding in the local capital markets in Nigeria, as an example. For companies like Fair Money, InterSwitch, etc. And then on capital raise advisory, we do capital raise advisory. We do that both for, you know, techs, fintechs, but also more mature companies. And what I can say, it's quite difficult for everyone. It's not difficult just in this sector. It takes quite a long time. It takes quite a long time to find the, you know, the investors, particularly at the valuation that that companies want. We do that work, and I suppose our job is to try and find, you know, the investors or any new investors that potentially, you know, would enter the continent. And I guess ultimately, we aspire to advise companies in the tech space to list on exchanges. We've done it for other African companies. Our bank has led most of the African companies' IPOs, both on the LSE and on local exchanges. And we're hopeful that that's going to be a path for some of the companies going forward. But also in the interim, one of the things that we're trying to focus on is consolidation, M&A advisory. It's very difficult. the market, particularly in the payment space, as an example, is quite fragmented. It's quite difficult to put companies together. Often very diverse, large shareholder groups, often big egos, etc. So we are trying, though, to drive some of that to create scale, because to exit, well, if you're too big in Africa, actually, it's more difficult to exit. But equally, you do need some scale, particularly if you're going to look at an IPO down the road. So there's been a little bit of M&A. I can't say that there has been a lot. It is quite challenging, but we are sort of actively trying drive that. And we think that part of the problem, of course, is capital. Where is capital going to come from for M&A? And often existing shareholders don't necessarily want to always be footing the bill. But we do think there could be some large private equity, both African and international, that could serve as catalysts for M&A on the continent. So that's what we're aiming to do.
Join us at Africa Tech Summit Nairobi in February, where African tech connects. Please visit africatechsummit.com/Nairobi for more details. Use discount code RAINEST, that's RAENEST, to receive a discount off delegate passes. To hear our latest episodes, please subscribe to our channel on your favorite app. You can also visit africatechsummit.com for our upcoming events and news.
Almost all the founders in this room, including myself, whatever we are pitching, we put Africa in the name to make the big, to make the pie large enough for everyone to see. However, scaling across Africa market is difficult. So people that are looking to scale, and I want contribution from everyone here, what are the things you think founders should know about scaling across Africa?
I think there's a capital budgeting question here, that you can sell this big story of Africa as one continent and it's a top line story.
Yeah.
But obviously each market that you enter has a certain capital cost to do so.
Yeah.
And in a capital constrained environment, that can be, it's a classic trade-off, right? Do you want to do the really big risky bet, or do you want to establish product market fit in your core geography, maybe even get some solid unit economics going before you go stage by stage into separate markets? I think that it's a bold move to burn too much cash in the current environment. I'm a cautious person, so I would encourage caution.
Okay. Also, before you answer, let me just break it down for everyone as well. So for you, this is a startup that has over African countries in the pool. It's a diverse market. So what are the cultural differences that you see from the team, and how do you guys manage it?
There are meaningful cultural differences within country offices, across different country offices. To speak to how we've thought about expansion more recently, so we've embarked on a fairly aggressive M&A growth strategy over the past 4 years. So we've acquired 4 businesses over the past 4 years. And with that, there's been, I would say, an evolution to our culture. And we've acquired teams in Lagos, Nigeria. We acquired a team in Tulsa, Oklahoma. We acquired part of a team in Nairobi. And each of those brought different challenges. I think the most important part for us as a business was to not impose our culture upon them, but to evolve our combined culture together. One of the things we found early on with our M&A activity is that it was very much a, oh, you're legacy X company, and we're legacy, at that time, MFS Africa. What we have really tried to do, and this is part of the rebranding exercise from MFS Africa to Onafrique, is say, you know, both of those companies are now in the past, and where we exist now is in a combined entity. There is a fresh culture associated with that, and that's what we've really tried to push.
Okay, so I will build up on that as well. I know, like, you guys were big before you do rebranding as well, and I was just Googling you guys, and it was difficult before I see anything that is straightforward on what you are. What is it like for a company that is that big to do a massive rebranding?
It's very expensive, so think twice if you want to do it. And you have to have really good people leading it. It's very similar. Elizabeth was talking about this earlier, sort of how important your team is. It required our legal team to think about what this meant for our licenses. It required our finance team to think what this meant for our bank accounts. You have to go so deep, and making sure that you've ticked and tied all of your loose ends is a challenging exercise, but a very important one. And all in all, I think it's been a net positive for us as a business.
All right, so it's expensive.
Yeah.
So, and for Move, I'm glad you've been there since they were 6 months since the launch. How did you guys scale communication from the beginning till now? I have a team of like 40 something, and sometimes it could be a nightmare. So internet communication, how did you scale it? And also to your partners, the riders, how do you scale communication?
So we're still learning, for sure. I think, so actually in terms of customer communication, we try to decentralize it as much as possible so that the teams in market, the people that are closest to, that understand the customer pain points the best, that are interfacing with them every day, we're empowering them to be able to do that with the right kind of level of central support in terms of kind of corporate guidelines, brand guidelines, and kind of key messaging. And then on crisis management as well, kind of we have some central policies, but ultimately we try and empower the local teams. From the principle of how do we serve our customers best, you know, what do they need from, you know, initial sign up all the way through to all the way through their life. Their life cycle and their time with us at Move. In terms of corporate communication, so our internal communications team is actually very, very small. It was me on day one. We now have two people external and then two people like internal. And I think we try and start first principles, like what kind of company do we want to be? And therefore, how does that translate into the way that we communicate, the way that we engage, and the way that we build our culture? And so we have people in 10 different cities, but we actually have people in probably something like 19 different countries. And so, you know, async, Slack, email, town halls every quarter. It used to be every month, but we've just tried to pivot and adapt as we've grown. And then we also do pulse surveys with our employee base to understand where are there potential gaps of understanding, lack of context, or just any areas that we can improve upon as a business. But it's definitely an iterative process and continuous process of ensuring that that everyone has the right level of information at the right time, all the time. One of my personal mottos when I communicate with my teams, and I try and kind of encourage others to do the same within the executive team, is you may think that you've said this, you've made your point and people have heard you, but like you probably have to say it 5, 6, 7, 8 more times before people actually hear you. So just be a lot more proactive and consistently, you know, whatever the message is, over multiple channels, because everyone's really busy and it's okay, right? Because we're trying to help each other, we're trying to be more effective and more efficient.
I like the communication part because I'm still learning myself and want to see how to scale to be like Move. Victor, so when we are looking at trust, because your platform is mostly about trust, how will the freelancers and people you're building for, how will they trust you? So how are you guys navigating trust across different markets beyond your primary market? How will you get a Kenyan to trust these Nigerian guys just building for them?
Good question, which is very important for any payment company, because you need people to trust you for them to like give you your money. At the early days when we started Very Nice, I think one of the things we did was to put ourselves first. For me, my life has always been around software development and product management, so I've been a freelancer. I know what it takes to like being a freelancer, kind of telling the story of the challenge. And then I was able to navigate it manually, and based on that problem, we want to solve this particular challenge. So people kind of look at who are the founders. Okay, I've been at Andela, which is like a popular freelancing platform. I was part of the people that built JumiaPay. One of my co-founders too was at Fair Money, Lenfa, and the rest. So we kind of put ourselves outside first for people to know who we are. And then we start by leveraging partnership. We partner with different banks in the US and UK. So we kind of put the name of the banks that, okay, this bank account is being issued by XYZ company. This is FDIC insured US bank account. This NDIC insured Nigeria banks account. So we started by doing that. And then a lot of educating users by different FAQ what are the common questions that I want to ask? Is your platform safe? Is my money protected? So we try to do all those things. And then customer testimonies. So we try to, we started with like a few customers that signed up and trusted us. Then we use their testimony, share it, let people see it. And then we started working with communities. So head of the communities, talk to them, get them to like use our platform. So they will go back and talk to their community. So it's like a referral coming from someone they trusted as well. And then we started working on couples of things on our end in terms of license, in terms of certification for users that want to go in depth and see what license do you have, how are you securing your platform. I think these are couples of things we do. And then part of the reason why we did some form of accelerator back then as well is to kind of increase the trust. People kind of, are you backed by YC? Are you backed by Techstars? Kind of increase the trust as well. For us, we've not done any fundraising announcements, though we've raised funds. I think user kind of, one of the things we notice is that user kind of trust you when they notice you've raised funds. So for us that we've raised and we didn't announce, I think it was something we later realized that, okay, we should have announced the two and we've raised, so that user would know we have $5 million, $10 million, and their fund itself. So we started working with news agency as well, some publications, right? So those are the approaches we use at the early stage. But now everybody's familiar with Venice, with KickPay, so they can easily come, keep their funds, as plenty as it might be, on the platform.
Nina, you mentioned Fair Money in the Switch and some of these other people. You work with different funders in Africa. What are the traits you've seen in different funders from different regions or different countries? Are there some similarities or differences?
Obviously, lots of visionaries, individuals that really have passion and that really want to solve a problem. And we all know that there are a lot of problems to be solved. And in Africa, and tech, you know, is playing quite a big role. Have seen some founders come from big companies. Very difficult for some of those individuals to adapt to an environment where you haven't got the massive organization behind you. You know, you can't really go there and spend pretty much, you know, whatever you want to spend, etc. You know, some impressive individuals, but potentially it's kind of the wrong job for them or very difficult for them to adapt. We have seen situations where the relationship between the founder and the funders or investors is quite strained. It has, in some cases, really impacted the growth of the company, but we've seen the reverse as well. So you've got everything kind of out there. I'm not going to talk to nationalities, I suppose. I don't know. I mean, you know, the nationalities apply to any company in Africa, whether it's a tech company or other, but yeah.
This is my last question, and I will start with you. I just want everyone to actually comment on this. Right now, is fintech here, fintech there, fintech everywhere on the continent. So are there other industries that you see are coming up, and what are the industries that you want to see more on the continent as we go beyond fintech or outside of it?
Yeah, no, there's been a lot of investment. In fact, investment into fintech has been declining, and constantly, steadily declining. And we've seen quite a lot of investment into clean tech, obviously, massive area, logistics, health tech, agri tech, and marketplaces. So when we talk about fintech, I think we use it a bit loosely. We actually mean tech across many verticals, not just fintech. But yeah, we're seeing quite a lot of investment. And I think I spoke about thematics earlier. That's where that applies. So different industries, different verticals, you're starting to see even some of the, you know, global corporates, like I said earlier, coming in and investing. You know, you've seen oil majors invest into Africa, you know, into clean tech and renewables and such like. And so I think there is quite a lot of appetite because there is quite a lot to do in Africa and quite a lot of problems to solve, if you will.
Okay, thank you so much. Because of time, I would just want, I just need everyone to mention their top industry outside of tech, fintech that you mentioned. So David.
Yes, so I would say edutech and logistic.
Okay, that's true.
I would say green energy and healthcare.
And healthcare, okay.
Productivity.
productivity?
Climate, which encompasses so much.
Okay, thank you so much, everyone, for joining me on this conversation. And thank you. So please, a round of applause. Can you stand up?
Join us at Africa Tech Summit Nairobi in February, where African tech connects. Please visit africatechsummit.com/Nairobi for more details and use discount code RAINEST, that's RAENEST, to receive a discount off delegate passes.